Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan.
There's an old adage, and I don't know if it's scientifically provable. However, there's an old adage that says, smoke follows beauty. And if you've ever been seated around a campfire, it seems as though that every time you readjust due to smoke, it does in fact follow you. Now, whether or not I'm beautiful or not is certainly debatable, but it does seem to follow us, doesn't it? No matter how you readjust yourself. And I love a good campfire. There's a place that I go to with just my wife and I. It's a little island in the middle of a river that we cruise up and down in our boat. And we bring wood with us and we'll just sit there by the fire on this little island. I enjoy the warmth of it. I enjoy the peace of it, just listening to the water and the sound of the birds. But you know, I got to tell you, a fire and smoke, we do find peace in it, but you know, they're two of the most destructive elements in the world as well. They wreak havoc, and I have stood over bodies for years, working house fires and accidental events involving explosions where fire resulted. And sometimes fire and smoke wipe away everything, including evidence. But in the case I want to discuss with you today, the absence of something actually led to the conviction of a murderer. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Now, Dave, I got to tell you, I'm not going to say you're beautiful, but you're a rather handsome man. Does smoke follow you when you go out to sit around a campfire at any point in time? Has it ever followed you? You know, the old song, smoke gets in your eyes.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, the Platters.
Yeah.
There more of go. Smoke from a distant fire. Sanford yeah. Townsend Band.
Wow.
We could play. Yeah, I know we could play this all day.
Smoke on the water. Hey, we didn't touch that.
Oh, no. Sometimes we shouldn't. At any yeah. rate, I've never actually heard that term used that way.
Yeah. But smoke follows beauty.
Yeah.
It's inconvenient because it does follow you. But, you know, Dave, I got to tell you, you know, with smoke and forensics, we don't just look at the destruction of that fire causes in fire related deaths, but we also look at the evidence that smoke actually leaves behind. And in today's
evidence,
case,
that's smoke leaves behind.
Yeah, the smoke, and you know, because the smoke is evidence of an item being consumed, right? And
right.
if you look, and I urge okay. anybody that's listening to us today, the next time you're around a fire, hopefully a controlled fire like
right.
a campfire, pay close attention to the fire itself, because not everything is consumed by the fire and the heat itself. You'll see things that kind of go up in the air. There'll be debris
mm-hmm.
contained, you know, little bits of debris, ash, that sort of thing.
Right.
And then the smoke itself does, in fact, leave behind evidence of things at a chemical level as well. And the smoke carries that, like on a magic carpet almost, that comes into our bodies. Kind of cool, isn't it?
It is. And
when
now
you think about that.
And knowing that today we're talking about the death of a woman, 27 years old, Melissa Lamish, who was 9 months pregnant. Mm. She was due any day. So
yeah.
we've got a baby that is viable. We're not just
has been viable for some time,
right.
Dave.
The baby can be born and be healthy, and that's what we were dealing with here. So we're not just talking about the death of a pregnant woman. We're talking about the death of two people here. One, an infant yet to be born, and the other's only 27 years old, and Melissa Lamish. And her body was discovered in a fire. And I went to a couple of different sites looking for how it was initially reported. Her death was reported as she died in a fire. And I thought, okay, it happens. People do die in fires. I know this. But knowing right. the Paul Harvey on this, the rest of the story, yeah. I was shocked at the way it was initially reported, because the reason we're talking about this today, is it wasn't just a fire. And as a matter of fact, Joe, did Melissa Lamish and her unborn 9-month old babe, ready to be born baby, did they die from a fire? Or did they die somewhere else?
Let's go back just a second, because a lot of folks out there, when they hear the term dying in a fire or dying as a result of a fire, I think that many people mistakenly assume that these cases that we work as death investigators, people are literally burned to death.
Yeah.
You know,
that's not it.
That is not the rule. That most of the time, that is not the rule. Now, you can have cases where there, as a matter of fact, I'll give you an example. Do you recall from when we were kids, there's that class, I think it won a Pulitzer Prize. There was that image of the Buddhist monk that had set himself on fire.
Boy, what commitment.
And struck a match. You know, he poured gas or an accelerant all over his body. And I think that was in protest of the war, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. A bit of irony that, as a matter of fact, I was just lecturing on this past week on fire-related deaths at Jacksonville State. And I'd never paid attention really to this before. I had two photos of that event, and one was taken so that you're looking back over his burning body into the street. And there is a guy. He looks like a policeman, and he's casually walking toward the body of the guy that's on fire. I guess he's still alive at that point in time. And Dave, he's taking a cigarette out of a pack as he's approaching the body. And I know that that's just, and everybody smoked back then, right?
Right.
You know, our parents smoked, everybody smoked. So, but it's just, you know, you capture that image and, you know, your mind can go to really dark places when you begin to think about it. But most people do not necessarily burn up. Now, people die of burns. Many times that happens where people sustain such extensive burning that they have to go to the hospital. They're on the burn unit for a protracted period of time. And the main thing that actually winds up killing individuals or causes the death, it came about as a result of the fire, but many of these people die of septicemia because they just develop widespread infections. And you wouldn't believe some of the things that are done to patients that have sustained burns. I think probably one of the most painful things you hear them talk about is these individuals that have to be scrubbed. They're scrubbed with a special soap, and they have to remove the dead skin because within there you have this kind of necrotic thing going on where infection can set it. And as the nerve endings begin to come back, it's very painful. I mean, it's one of the most horrible things in the world. Burn units are horrible places to go to. There's always kind of this foul odor that's there. And one of the things that was so shocking that I would work as a death investigator, somebody that had been on a burn unit and they finally died, they would have gone through many times multiple surgeries. And I'm not talking about for skin grafts. Did you know that when people are burned, they will do these long north-south incisions all over the body and they're left open? And the reason that occurs is so that as the healing process takes place, or as they are sitting there kind of in stasis in place, the skin doesn't split. And so they actually go ahead and open the skin up. And again, that has the potential for sepsis as well. It's a very dicey environment to be in. So when you hear people say, well, they burned to death or they died as a result of a fire, you have to qualify that, because most people that are in an environment, particularly like a closed dwelling, a home,
like
not
a
so
house,
much out
right.
in a, yeah, a home or a car. If they're trapped in the car and there's flame, and the flame is, you remember, flames consume things. You know, famously, there's that line that Robert De Niro used in Backdraft. He said that you have to envision fire as a living, breathing entity. And it truly is. It's consuming oxygen. It's trying to seek a height so it can get to as much oxygen as it can. You're there in that environment. And what did they always tell us in the event of a house fire when we were kids? Do we stand up and walk for the
door? Down low. No, crawl.
Down low, baby. You got to crawl. And if you crawl, there might still be oxygen at that level, and you're not going to be inhalating as much smoke. And what's really the killer here, the lethal portion of this, is the inhalation. of the debris, the smoke itself, because it is a pathway for all kinds of toxins.
I just remember Dick Van Dyke's public service announcement, stop, drop, and roll.
Yeah, yeah. Man, I'd forgotten all about that. And there's a lot of truth to that. And stop, drop, and roll actually comes from individuals that are literally ignited, you know, where mm-hmm. their clothing catches on fire and you're having to roll about. And the idea is to, if you roll, you're going to extinguish the fire as you roll back and forth. Kind of a funny little story. When my wife and I first got married, she would come into the bathroom and take a seat and talk to me while I was in the shower, because I worked nighttime, and I worked at nights. And so I would take a shower late at night before I would get in the car and go to the medical examiner's office. And she always burned candles. Always. She had a candle burning all over the house. Of course, now they say that they're all, well, everything in this world is lethal, it seems like now. But she had the big kind of 90s hair, you know, with the hairspray. And
Aquanet.
I looked around the corner of the shower curtain to respond. You ever do that where you have to make eye contact? Mm-hmm. And we were kind of joking back and forth. So I pulled the curtain back to look at her to make a response. And Dave, the back of her head was on fire. And she had leaned back on the toilet and the candle was there and it caught her. And I had to take the shower curtain and wrap it around her head. And she, I don't know, I guess she thought I was about to murder her or something.
She didn't know her hair was on fire?
She didn't know.
Wow.
Of course, soon it was evident because of the smell and the air, right. The hair burning.
Wow.
But you know, that does happen. And it's not just the flame itself. That's so damaging. It's not just the smoke, but here's another thing, and this is something that we try to find at autopsy. You've got superheated air in this environment, and flames are obviously very dangerous. Smoke is very dangerous, but when you're inhaling superheated air, it is actually burning your nostrils. The interior of your nostrils, all those mucoid linings in there, the interior of your mouth, and even down your throat. And so what happens at autopsy, when we begin to explore these areas at autopsy, you'll see this kind of inflamed red area that's there. And it'll really give you an idea as to how, first off, how long they were exposed to breathing up this hot air. But Dave, here's the thing. If you're absent these kind of scorched linings, if you can't find anything relative to that, your answer relative to the cause of death rests somewhere else. Fire setters, fire bugs, pyromaniacs, they go by a litany of names that are out there. Who sets fires? Why do they set fires? There's all kinds of motivations for doing it. The biggest thing, I think most of the time, from a criminal standpoint, you know, you get off into pyromania, you start talking about sexual related stuff, and that is a real thing. But you begin to think about, you know, why do people set fires? And I don't know if you agree with me, Dave. I think most of the time they have an idea that they're going to eradicate something, that they're going to erase something, that they're going to get rid of evidence. I got to tell you, Bubba, most of the time when people intentionally set a fire, they don't realize this. They might eradicate some evidence, but you know what? At the end of the day, they wind up creating different evidence and more evidence lots of times. And I don't think that they fully grasp that.
The things I don't know until I talk to you are the list is getting longer because I didn't know. I thought, okay, in this particular case, we have a 27-year-old woman dead. They say it's dead from fire, but right away, as she's an EMT. Did we say that already? Okay.
No.
Let me give you the background.
That's the thing about it.
She's an EMT. Sure. She's actually on maternity leave, or not maternity leave, but she has taken time off in preparation for the arrival of her first child. And then she'll have some time off after that.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine an EMT being nine months pregnant and having to handle a gurney going down an interior staircase? Yeah. Can you imagine?
So she's got her little time off. But let me give you a little insight into Melissa Lamesh at 27 years old. She actually had a side hustle, a side gig. She actually hosted trivia nights with Pub Trivia USA. It's a national, it's a company that basically pays people to go in and they host a game night in these different little pubs and things. And you've got to have a pretty big personality. You got to be quick on your feet. Got to be fairly smart. Yeah. And you have to keep the game moving along. That's the type of person we're talking about. Somebody that people like to be around and was fun, genial. I find it interesting because oftentimes we don't realize what we're missing because we don't know that person personally. That's who we're talking about. Somebody like that at 27 that is expecting her first child. Now, the setup for that day, earlier in the day, her ex-boyfriend, who is the father of her unborn child, he came by. His name's Matthew Plote. Now, Matthew Plote is 36 years old, and he came by to see her earlier in the day. I don't know a lot about their background, their relationship or anything else. You know, you just kind of know that he's an EMT as well. So they met on common footing there and they were expecting their first child. The report is that, of course, they are exes. They're not involved in a relationship at this time. And she is about to give birth. So he goes over to see her that day. And from what we know, as we've already told you, she died, you know, that day in a fire. And yet, we know that he actually said that he went over and saw her and that they had sex that day. I'm thinking he's trying to explain why his DNA is found inside the house, or, you know, that's what I'm guessing. He's trying to explain his presence there that day. And instead of saying, yes, I went there and I killed her, he's saying, no, I went there and had sex and I left, you know, which bottom line, he was there that day and she ends up dead. But Joe, what happens when you take a body such as hers? I wonder what information you're going to find, forensically speaking, from the body of a pregnant woman who is about to give birth. Are you going to be able to get physical information from the baby that has not been born? And what information are you going to get from this body? Because we do know there were two autopsies done.
I think that, and listen, procedurally, I think that many people don't understand that when we're dealing with a female that is pregnant, there will be two autopsies.
Okay.
Because we actually, and it's one of the saddest things that you can do. For me personally, it always was. I can't speak to anybody else. You can put on your clinical hat and say that it doesn't impact
you. How could it not?
I'm here to tell you, my friend, it impacts you. To work in the morgue when you're working, you're doing an examination on a pregnant woman, you actually have to deliver the baby.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
You know, in the autopsy room. And it's not like a regular delivery. And it's something that you're very careful with. But that child's body is just as important as the mother's body, you know, regarding this event. And it's not so much that you're going to see, I'll put it to you this way. You know, one of the things that we do with individuals that are subject to fires and house fires and, you know, closed in spaces is that we're going to spend a lot of time looking at the lungs. Well, obviously if you have an unborn child, the lungs have not yet expanded at that point. So you know that they're not uptaking oxygen per se, but they're getting their nutrients from the mother. And anything that might be going on metabolically with the mother can in fact come into influence relative to the child or the unborn child that she's carrying. And this is actually evidenced with how many times have I know that you've worked with underprivileged people and you've worked with people that are severely drug addicted, you know, as part of what you do. And I couldn't do it. I don't know how you do it, but many people that are pregnant and they have an addiction problem, that addiction will be passed on to the unborn child. I'll tell you this, one of my dearest friends in the entire world was born addicted. And it's a real uphill struggle, but those are the types of things you can find from the unborn child. But primarily in a case like this, you're There are any number of reasons why a pregnant woman could potentially suddenly die. But you don't, that's not necessarily always going to be your default position, particularly when you find her in a burning house.
I want to ask something because, you know, I have said that, you know, she died in a house fire. And while that might be somewhat accurate, it's not accurate at all. Because that's the way it was reported. I before we even started, remember, I went to a GoFundMe site. I wanted to see, you know, how it was approached at the time, how it was reported at the time. And and that is how it was sold, how the story was told, that this woman who was 9 months pregnant died in a house fire. But, Joe, when they got there, when they got to the house, when a fireman got to the house, her house was on fire. We have looked at pictures of the house on fire. She was not dead. She was unconscious in the kitchen, I believe. But they said she was unconscious when they got there. And they were able, they being the experts here, and we're going to talk about the autopsy, but they were able to determine exactly what happened to her, and the fire is not what killed her. How did we know that, Joe?
We know that, Dave, because of the examination that was conducted at the medical examiner's office. You know, one of the things that if you find a body that has been contained in an enclosed environment like this with all of the smoke and the superheated air that we've previously talked about, you're going to look for these little bits of evidence along the way that can be displayed in the body. And they're not finding that. They're not finding like an uptake of, say, carbon monoxide. And we run a test that's referred to as the carboxyhemoglobin level, which is when we do a blood draw. And here's something kind of interesting. When you actually see the blood of an individual that has been exposed to carbon monoxide, did you know that their blood is actually brilliantly cherry pink? And you can visualize that. It doesn't require any kind of special testing, but you do test it, and you do what's called a carboxyhemoglobin level, and it gives you that level of carbon monoxide in their system. Now, every single day when you go about living your life and you're walking up and down the street, you're going to work, you're going to school, there's a certain amount of carbon monoxide that we uptake just in our environment. And that's kind of a baseline. There are all kinds of things that we inhale that are not lethal in minimal amounts. You can uptake carbon monoxide at a very minimal amount, but it's not going to kill you. But if you're in that environment and that product is being given off and you're inhaling it, say you're like moving around in that environment and you're really struggling to breathe, you're going to take these deep gasps and it's going into your system. I think what they're saying is if she did in fact have even an agonal respiration, you know, where it's like very minimum, she's down low, I think they found her on the floor, she's not going to uptake hardly any at all at that point in time. She eventually succumbs. The other thing you're going to look for, and I kind of hinted at this earlier, the gas, the air is so superheated in this environment, Dave, that for anybody that's, I'll give you an example, and this doesn't actually even come close, but I remember when I was a very young man, I went to Arizona for training in the Army, and I'd never been to Arizona, and I got there in July. And I remember,
you know, the devil goes to Arizona in the July and he says, man, it's hot.
Well, they always told me, you know, it's a dry heat. You're from the South. It's not going to bother you. Dude, it bothered me. I loved Arizona. I've got friends from Arizona, but it ain't where, particularly Southern Arizona is not a place I'd want to hang out during the summertime. And when I remember walking out of the airport and getting on an Army bus and took my first like full breath of air, and it felt like my lungs were on fire. Well, you imagine that, and it's because the air was so superheated. You imagine that only you're inside of a house fire, and it's going to literally scorch those delicate little linings. We all know what it feels like. You know, to my friends listening right now, think about how it feels when you have like strep throat or something like that. And you can actually look in the mirror and look in your throat, and you'll see that it's really red and inflamed. It's so painful. imagine that by a factor of 10. And that's how it would feel, you know, trying to just uptake oxygen into your body, but there's none there because the fire, like I said earlier, is living. It's trying to consume all of the oxygen in the air. And so if your answers don't rest there in a chemical test, they've got to rest somewhere else. So where do we look for answers? Well, you know, in this case, Melissa, when she died, her body bore evidence, Dave, and the forensic pathologist that was involved in this case, trust me, they've seen house fires before, and they're looking for obvious signs of what may have led to her death. And it was pretty glaring. It was pretty glaring when this autopsy began to proceed. As a matter of fact, I think there was one quote that from the forensic pathologist that they had not seen this many particular hemorrhages in a case. And that, for me, that was really striking because I've had cases where you've got petechiae all over the place. It's not just in the eyes. People think that it's only in the eyes. It can be all over. And in this case, she was just
okay. Well, let's back up to that for a minute, because when we have talked about petechiae before, it usually comes in the context of a discussion of what you're looking for in somebody who may have been strangled, suffocated. And in this case, I'm not a doctor or anything close to it, but I'm going to assume that you're going to look at somebody and find out that they've got soot and stuff in their lungs. There's going to be some manner of breathing in, right? And
right, you're
if
right.
That's not there, then whatever happened to this person had nothing to do with the fire. And
yeah, they were unconscious.
So would you have that? Would you have petechiae and things like that? If I died in a fire, okay, let's just say that I die from breathing in whatever, I die because of the fire, but nothing else. Am I going to have petechiae all over me? My eyes? Am I going to look like I was strangled?
In the event that it was an asphyxial death, yeah, you would, and not all over you. And this is very important to understand because there are levels of trauma. And let me see if I can phrase this accurately. They're dependent upon, okay, here we go. Dependent upon the amount of pressure that is applied to your airway, whether it be your throat externally with either bare hands or ligature, or somebody placing something over your face that's going to inhibit your ability to uptake oxygen, and how much force is used. You could have minimal, dependent upon the amount of force. You could have a tremendous number if they're just squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. And here's why. And it's very, very simple. It's not rocket science, as I always say. We're not going to the moon here, okay? The more pressure that you apply to, say, for instance, the neck, if we're talking about a strangulation, like a manual strangulation, you're not just blocking the vessels in the neck. And the two that we really think about here are the carotids that run on either side of what's referred to as your trachea. As those are being clamped down, you're not just preventing oxygenated blood to be sent to your brain, but you're also preventing that return of the blood coming back from the brain. And what happens? Well, it holds up in these little capillary beds, and capillary beds are not meant for blood storage. They're meant for blood flow. And so the more pressure that is exerted there, you'll have these little vessels that are bursting, and they burst out into the interstitial tissue. And it doesn't matter if a perpetrator picks up on this and they see it, there's no way you can get rid of them. No way. As a matter of fact, if an individual that dies presents with petechiae, because this is outside the vessels now, if you were to look at an embalmed body that had petechiae are not going to go away.
So you would see it after the fact for a while. I mean,
Yeah. Because it's out into, it's what's called the interstitial tissue, the tissue that surrounds the vessels. The vessels burst. Just think of it this way, okay? If you have a water hose in your, you know, in your yard, and you've got the nozzle on the end of it, and it's closed, and you turn it on full blast, once that hose burst, okay, you cannot reclaim that water, say, you know, gather it back up and put it back into the hose once you get it patched. It's out in the dirt. That dirt is going to be sopping wet at that point in time. It's the same principle. You see, it's, as I said, it's you know, we're not doing calculus here. It's just, that's the reality of it. And so when the pathologist began their exam of Melissa, they found no soot in her lungs. So I think that the phraseology that I'm using here is important to think about. Did she die as a result of a fire? No, this is obviously for the forensic pathologist, a person that had died, and then the environment around her was set ablaze. And even the fire marshal made a distinction about that. And I find this quite interesting, Dave, because they have what I think to be what's called a splash pattern.
From
a splash pattern.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me back up for just a sec.
Okay.
So now we have petechiae all over. We have no soot in her mouth, throat, heading into her lungs. We got none of that. So you say, okay, there was a fire, but that's not what was involved in killing her. So now you start tracking it back and you find out that the father of her unborn child is also an EMT, and he had been over there earlier in the day, and he admits that when they're talking to him. Now, over the next couple of days, he goes on about his merry business. People are not, they're like, he's not showing any signs of any kind of grief or anything. And you would think somebody's carrying your child, they might have some kind of feelings of sadness that you were gone, regardless of how the relationship was. So those were little things that people kind of caught on to that. So as they're asking Matthew Plote, you know, what was going on that, you know, you were over there that day. Well, what was going on? And he tells them, well, we had sex and then I left. So he's already put himself at the scene of a crime. It's not a fire that happened and she died. She was dying before the fire was set. And as they're examining, you mentioned splash pattern. I'm going to assume that this EMT set the fire.
Yeah, and I think that it's important also, not to say that anyone else could not have set the fire, but not only was this guy an EMT, he's also a firefighter, which a lot of my friends that are in the fire service are EMTs as well. And firefighters, I got to tell you, are some of my favorite people in the world, because they work so hard. And unlike my friends that are police officers, they don't want to get their uniforms dirty lots of times. Firefighters, anytime I had like a really bad case, like something that was really, really bad, they'd say, hey, how can we help you? We've got a new device we want to try out, or a new knot we want to try out and they're always willing to help. They have a broad range of knowledge. And so if you've got someone that is in fact a firefighter, you know that they're going to understand things like point of origin. Because that's one of the things that you try to discover. Not only are you fighting fires, you're trying to discover how the fire initiated. And this knowledge kind of trickles down through the service. That's what's so odd about this, because I think that if I'm not mistaken, I think that there was the investigators actually noted that there was what appeared to be like a splash pattern or a point of initiation at the scene that was immediately adjacent to to an air
above vent. The stove.
So if you take above the stove, and just imagine this, if you took a bucket of water on a dry, hot day, and you went out to your driveway on a concrete surface, and you took that bucket of water and you splashed it out, in the immediate, you could see that pattern. You could see the pattern of the splash itself on that surface. All right. So we've established that. The same way, Dave, with an accelerant like lighter fluid or kerosene or gasoline, when you take a liquid accelerant like that, you can spray it on an area. Well, what are you going to do next? You're going to strike a match or initiate a lighter, and you're going to start the fire right there. Well, there's two things you look for. You look for what's referred to as a splash pattern, which the fire literally burns. It will actually burn that pattern into the wall from the splash. And not only that, one of the ways that I'm fascinated by people that do arson investigation, it's really the unsung hero in forensic science. They don't get a lot of love, but boy, what they have to do, that the job is amazing, absolutely amazing. They're so brilliant, because if you ever walk onto a fire scene, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, and all of the pieces are black and charred. You have to have a different mindset to work one of these scenes. But what they look for point of origin many times is the area that is most damaged in that structure is generally going to be your point of origin, because that's where the fire will have burned the hottest. And in this case, that's what they were seeing. They knew that this thing had to have been initiated. Now, they're going to, you know, you talk about how this is adjacent to the stove. So one of the things that your mind goes to, was this as a result of, say, some kind of electrical malfunction? All right. Did the fan short out, you know, in the stove, you know, with the fan that's in your hood of your stove, something behind it? Did something initiate this? And all of these things present differently. But it's amazing to me that someone that is a firefighter would actually do this and leave.
That's
this
what, when I was looking over the whole case, I was wondering the same thing, except we're not dealing with a firefighter hero. We're dealing with a firefighter, possible murderer, who possibly murdered his ex-girlfriend and a baby who's not ready to be born. And putting that into play, now you're going, okay, let's back up for just a minute. Joe, do you know how early they suspected Matthew Plote that night? The night they put the fire out and the family comes to him and they say, hey, you got to check out the boyfriend. You got to check him out. And they did. They sweated him for 7 hours. And during the 7 hours they're talking to him, he admits to being there. He claims they had sex. He's admitting a lot of things, but he doesn't admit to killing anybody. He doesn't admit to killing the unborn baby. He doesn't admit to killing Melissa. But one thing that happened that this caught my attention, Joe, they know he was there the day of the fire. They know she's got no soot in her mouth, in her throat. They know that right away. They also know they can't find fingerprints anywhere. The place has been wiped down. Now, why would a place be wiped down? Why are we not finding your fingerprints? You told us you were there. That immediately is going to, you know, ding, ding, ding. The last thing that her sister, Melissa Lamish, has a sister that she was on the phone with and said, hey, Matt's coming by. I'll call you after he leaves. And she never called back. That was really out of character. And the sister brought that up very early on in the investigation. So we know he's there. We know that she was supposed to call back her sister. She never did. Fire happens and there's no fingerprints inside from the one guy who admits he was there.
Yeah. I'm thinking right here and I'm thinking about Melissa's sister. Can you imagine when she got that phone call? Because, you know, she knows, she probably knows more than anybody about the dynamics of that relationship. And she also knows a key piece of information relative to his presence in or lack thereof in her life. And so, you know, that's fascinating to consider. And she's going to be key to the investigation. But back to the fingerprints, it's one thing to burn an area down or set a place ablaze and you won't find fingerprints. But that gives you an idea that there was some level of containment of the fire, that it was isolated to one location, that location being not too far away from where the body was. And so, everything else has been wiped down. And look, when you go in and you dust an area for latent prints, which are those things that are unseen, and that powder sticks to those fatty lipids that your fingers, your friction ridges leave behind, you're absent there. You know, you can imagine the look on the print guy sitting there and saying,
right,
I can't find a print anywhere. You know, there's no prints. And so, you know, isn't it interesting how a perpetrator is trying to leave nothing to chance, but yet by virtue of leaving nothing to chance, you kind of give it away. And this goes back to another premise that you and I have both talked about, David. Sometimes in this old world, the absence of evidence is just as important as the presence of evidence.
It shocked me when I read it, because even though it's just me and I'm just covering stories and things like that, I am amazed at how many times this type of tidbit comes up, because I'm thinking there's no way. You know, you admit you're there, then your prints there should be something left behind. We've learned that over time. But Joe, to back up for a minute, just the condition of the body and the baby when they get them out of the house and you take them back to the morgue. I didn't know about having she's 9 months pregnant, she's about to give birth, that baby has to be born in the morgue. And you said there has to be an autopsy done on the baby as well.
Yeah. That's commonly done. And it's very sad because, well, let's look at it this way, Dave. Okay. And I'm not trying to be callous, but this isn't really callousness, I don't think. It's just stating cold, hard fact.
Right.
You're looking at double homicide here. And that's important to remember. It's not just Melissa that has died at the hands of someone. It's this baby as well. And, you know, just let that sink in. So you don't want to move forward with a case if you charge somebody with double homicide, for instance, and you don't do the exam you wouldn't do it if it was, say, two adults and they were shot dead, you know, some location, and you find out, you suspect who did it, and you arrest them. You're going to do an autopsy on both of those subjects. Well, you're going to do an autopsy on the baby as well. And let me just clarify things. When mm-hmm. I say that we deliver the baby in the morgue, it's, again, I'd like to emphasize that it's not like a traditional delivery. It's not even like a C-section. It is a removal of the baby from the mother's womb. And we have a particular way that we do that in the morgue. So it's not a traditional delivery, but we have to take that baby and do an examination. And there's, when you do an exam on an infant, there's a whole nother set of rules that kind of apply, because there's other things that we're looking at relative to the baby where, you know, we consider things primarily having to do with developmental issues, you know, at what state was the baby in, and you have to go back and correlate that with any kind of prenatal treatment that she had received when you begin to think about viability, because this is going to come up in court. Because if you're going to charge somebody, the attorney is going to say, you're charging my client with a homicide, and we don't even know if the child was viable. Well, you have to examine that child and say, oh, no. This child was not deceased in utero. This child was viable, vibrant. The chances this child was going to survive the birth and thrive in life were really high. No, this individual should, and in this case was, charged. And I'm happy to report, Dave, that this individual has been found guilty.
Joe, he was convicted. Matthew Plote was convicted of first degree murder, homicide of an unborn child, arson, battery, and concealment of a homicide.
I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.